Okay, so today is June 9th, the 17th of Sivan. Hi, Louis. We just started.
I may have to run in and out. I have a contractor in the basement.
Okay, don't worry. Okay, so we are finishing the last few psukim of Perek Kaf. It seems to be an accepted notion that the end of Perek Kaf is actually the end of the chronological narrative of Sefer Shmuel, what we're finishing with the putting down of the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri. And then the remainder of the Sefer, we have a few more Perekim left, is out of chronological order and just deals with specific incidences. So Kaf Aleph, what we're starting today, is going to deal with a famine, a ra'av, that lasted 3 years, and it's going to tell the story and the history of that. And we're going to spend two, maybe three shiurim on that because it's really fascinating, and there's some background information that we have to understand in order to fully grasp it. But in the meantime, we are going to finish Perek Kaf. I'm just trying to
Can I
move.
just ask you, Stacey, the out of order parts, is there any idea when they happened? Do the Mefarshim say when they think they were?
Right, so Perek Kaf Aleph that we're going to start could be any time from 1 year after Shaul's death to 30 years into David HaMelech's reign. So there's no accepted notion of when it happened. I don't know about the remainder of the Prakim and the incidences that they describe. But I for the Ra'av, the famine, nobody agrees. The only thing that they all agree on is that it was definitely more than a year after the death of Shaul, because that has to do with what's going to happen, that they couldn't make up for not having a proper burial and eulogy for Shaul because it was more than a year. So that's the only thing they agree on. Okay, so the end of Perek Kaf, we have this little leftover. It's sort of like summing everything up for the remainder of David HaMelech's reign after this rebellion. And it begins, V'yoav el kol hatzava Yisrael, u'benaya ben Yehoyada al hakreti v'apleti. So Yoav was over the entire army of Israel, and Benaya, the son of Yehoyada, was over the, this could either be archers or slingers, it could be important families, whatever they are, they're like the warriors. So Yoav, if you remember, David wanted to remove him from his post and appoint Amasa, who we saw Yoav murdered on the way to just quell the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri. Benaya ben Yehoyada, if we continue on with Malachim, we'll learn more about him. He does eventually become the leader of the army under Shlomo. Ve'adoram al-Hamas, so Adoram was placed over taxes. Yehoshaphat ben Ahilud Hamazkir. So Yehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, the chronicler. Ushva, sofer. So this guy whose name is Shva was the scribe. I thought that was kind of funny because Shva is the vowel, the two dots, and that he's the scribe. I don't know why that struck me as funny. V'tzadok ve'Eviatar Kohanim. So Tzadok and Eviatar were Kohanim. V'gam Ira haya Iri, haya Kohen leDavid. And also Ira ve'Yairi, and this is interesting because Yair is the son of Menashe. So if he's the Yairi in the sense of being a descendant of Menashe, what does it mean that he was a Kohen? Or is it that, and you can see the translation here, that Kohen leDavid, rather than being an actual Kohen for David, and what would that mean anyway, and we're going to discuss that, perhaps he was just a chief official to David. He served. We have, for instance, Yitro is called Kohen Midian. He was the priest of Midian, so Kohen is a more universal word than the way we use it today to just be a priest within Judaism. Okay, so we're going to discuss that more. So here's the Malbim on these three psukim. So the questions are, Lama chashav hasarim ela po shenit? Why are we listing these ministers here for a second time. Ukvar niskar lamala sof siman chet. We already mentioned them all at the end of chapter 8. And I just want to show you that. I'm sorry I didn't include it. So here is from Chabad.org. So you have Yoav, who is over the army. It's funny, it translates it as host, like Hashem Tzvakot, Lord of Hosts, but Tzava means army. And Yehoshaphat is the chronicler. Tzadok and Achimelech are Kohanim. And Sraya, who's whatever it is in our book, the names are odd, so I don't remember, sorry, but everyone agrees that they're really the same person. It's not that there was a new scribe. Benayu ben Yehodia was a Kreti Apleti. And so he's last here, okay? So as opposed to in our case, where Benaya was first right after Yoav, okay?
Which psukim was that, Stacey? Which perek chet, which psukim?
Perek chet, the very end of perek chet.
Okay.
Okay, so they were already mentioned, and there doesn't seem to be any changes here. They all seem to maintain the same positions. So it's a good question. Why would we relist these ministers of David when there's no change? Okay, Lama Chashav Sham Benayu Ben Yehodeya Levasof. So Benayu was mentioned at the end there. Upo he's Kira Achar Yoav, and here he's right after Yoav. V'lama Hosif Po Adiram V'ira Ha'Yairi. So the only changes are these additions of Adiram and Ira. V'lama lo hizkir b'nei David shayu kohanim k'mo shekativ sham. And why did it not mention the sons of David? I don't think I mentioned. Right, so, sorry.
On the bottom.
Right, David's sons. Right, I didn't mention that. Thank you. Ubnei David Kohanim Hayu. So this is also gives you the use of that word Kohanim. So the sons of David were chief officers. They say here, obviously they weren't Kohanim. David is from Yehuda. Oh, shoot, sorry. I keep moving you guys on my screen and then blocking other stuff. Okay, so okay, so those are all his questions. You can see they're good questions. V'Yoav, Kvar Chashvam L'malas of Siman Chet. So we already mentioned Yoav and accounted for him at the end of Perek Chet. Rak Safa Shapo, sorry, Rak Shapo Chashvam B'Shinui Seder. But here it's in a different order. L'ma'an Navin Et HaMivukash. In order to understand what was being asked, Ki David hiskim la'avir et Yoav v'lasum et Amasa b'mokomo al hatzava. So David had agreed to remove Yoav and to place Amasa in his place on the army. Mipnei sheharag et Avshalom, because Yoav killed Avshalom. We had a whole discussion about that. V'lechein harag Yoav et Amasa. And therefore, Yoav, knowing that David planned to remove him, he killed Amasa. V'kasher nodaza l'David, and when this is made known to David, haya b'machshavato lasum et Benayahu ben Yehoyada b'mkomo. So then he wanted to promote Benaya instead of Yoav. Kamo she'na'ase achar kach b'mei Shlomo, just exactly as he tells Shlomo to do after he dies. I mean, he tells Shlomo to do it after David would die. That's one of his commands to Shlomo. Rak kasher shav Yoav v'hitzliach laharog et Sheva ben Bichri. It was only after Yoav returned and he succeeded in killing Sheva ben Bichri. Ra'a David ki lo yuchalo. David saw that he wouldn't be able to make this change. Ki Yisrael notim acharav, because Yisrael, all of Israel, was supporting Yoav. K'mo shekatav lamala, as it says above, v'hanashim b'nei Tzruya kashim imani. He says the b'nei Tzruya, this was after David says they're more difficult than me. I can't overcome them. Nishar hadavar kimikadem. So everything remained as it was before. V'Yoav nishar el kol hatzava Yisrael, and Yoav remained on all the army of Israel. Ratzol nomar v'mnei Yisrael nimshechu acharav. That is to say, since Israel were drawn after him, v'chein Benayahu nishar kimikadem al hakreti, and therefore Benayahu stayed over the Kreti and Pleti. Okay. She Yisrael Mardubo. Since Israel rebelled against David, he started collecting a tax over them. So there hadn't been taxes apparently before this, but I guess to quell the rebellion a little bit, David started collecting taxes and he appointed somebody over that. He hadn't collected it before. Kamosha Katov Mahari, like Abarbanel says, Umina et Adoram al Hamas. And he appointed Adoram over the taxes. How did this rebellion start? Because Avshalom stole the heart of the nation, saying that the king wasn't doing justice. And this complaint grew on the chronicler and the scribe. Shelo be'amna hem osim lahazkir v'lichtov kol haba'im al hamelech l'mishpat, that they didn't have trust, that they weren't trustworthy in the way that they recorded and wrote all that came to the king for justice. V'haya eza machshava lahaviram, and there was some thought to remove them. Yomar ki gam ela nisharu al mishmaratam. David said, no, your rebellion, it wasn't successful, it wasn't truthful, it was based on lies, they are remaining in their place. Because Avshalom had made all these evil devices. Kafhe, vehine besiman chet, chashav tzadok ben achituv, veachimelch ben aviatar kohanim. So that's the quote from Perek Chet, when it talks about tzadok ben achituv, veachimelch ben aviatar, priests. Velo chashav aviatar shahaya kohen gadol. It doesn't mention aviatar as the high priest. Ulam acharei maase Avshalom shelo ne'ana Aviatar be'orim v'tumim. It was after the incident of Avshalom where the Orim v'tumim did not answer Aviatar. Nistalek Aviatar. Aviatar was removed. V'haya b'madriga shaveh im tzadok. And he became on an equal level with tzadok. He was no longer the Kohen Gadol. L'chein amar po. And therefore it says here, she'tzadok ve'aviatar kohanim. Tzadok and Aviatar were just plain kohanim. Belamala and in chet amar shebnei David kohanim hayu. And it says that the sons of David served him, whatever this means. So Malvim explains there that they would sit, they were the first ones to sit right next to the king. But after the incident of Avshalom, nistalku misroatam, their power was removed from them. Because he had already decided that Shlomo would become the next king. And he was afraid. He thought maybe there would be some other second rebellion if they were to be sitting first in the ruling, the kingship. And each one would get haughty, saying, I'm the one who's going to rule. Uminab bimkomam et ira hayairi rabo. He appointed in their place Ira the Yairi, who was his Rav. We're going to see a midrash on that. Liot sorer bebeito ubal etzato. He would have power over his house and he would give him advice. Okay, so that's the reason for all these things. And it ends with Ira hayairi. Okay, so that's going to be relevant. We're going to see in a second. So let's start here. I'm keep debating whether or not to read. So this is a long parak, obviously, and these are just a few of the psukim, not all of them. But I think let's get a feel for what's happening in the beginning of this parak. So we'll read all of them, but we're not going to discuss them. So we'll have to repeat these psukim as well at a different later class. Vehi ra'av bimei David shalosh shanim, shana acharei shana. And there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. So you can tell this is already an unusual way of wording it. It's an unusual famine. And David sought the face of Hashem. You also see here that it seems like it wasn't until the third year that David sought out Hashem for how to deal with this famine, that the severity had gotten to that point. And here, just to point out, we have a paragraph break in the middle of a pasuk. It's going to happen also within these psukim that I brought for you. Vayomer Hashem el Shaul, the El Beit Hadamim, El Asher Hemit et Givonim. Okay, so Hashem gives an answer. It's cryptic and explicit at the same time. So we're going to obviously spend a lot of time exploring that. So to Shaul, into the house of blood that he killed the Givonim. So we're going to talk about the Givonim. So it seems, according to the Pshat, just to break it up, there's something specifically for Shaul, and then there's something for what Shaul did in terms of killing the Givonim. Okay, so we'll get back to that. We're not going to discuss that so much today. Ve'ikra hamelech leGivonim, and the king called to the Givonim. Ve'yomer aleihem, and he said to them, Ve'Givonim lo bin me. Okay, and he said to them, and here we have a parenthetical phrase. There would be parentheses here if it was in English. It probably is parentheses in English. I don't know. Okay, sorry. Ve'Givonim lo mibnei Yisrael hema. They were not a part of Bnei Yisrael. We're going to see how confusing this is. Ki imi yeter ha'emori, they're rather the remainder of the Amorites, and the Amorites were, I think they're Canaanites. Ubnei Yisrael nishba'u lahem, but Bnei Yisrael had sworn to them. So we're going to see what all this is talking about. V'yivakeh Sha'ul ha'kotam, but Sha'ul wanted to kill them, bekanoto, in his zealousness, livnei Yisrael v'Yehuda, in his zealousness for Bnei Yisrael and Yehuda. Okay? So don't worry, we're going to talk all about that today. V'yomer David al ha'givonim, so David said to the givonim, ma eselechem uvema achaper ubarchu et nachalat Hashem. So what can I do for you, and how can I atone and bless the inheritance of the Lord, of Hashem? Ve'yomru lo ha'givonim, and the givonim said to him, ein, you see in the brackets it's li, that's what's written, so in lanu kesef, we don't have kesef, silver, sorry, kesef is a high im sha'ul, we don't have any issue of silver or gold with sha'ul. So the Midrash says that David tried to approach each one individually to try to sort of pay them off. That's with the li. I don't have any silver or gold with Shaul. But really, you can see they all replied that. We don't have any. V'im beito, or with his household. V'ein lanu ish lehamit b'Yisrael. And we can't kill anyone in Israel. V'yomer ma'atam omrim eselchem. And he said, whatever you say, I will do for you. And they said to the king, Ha'ish asher kilanu, the man who destroyed us, v'asher dima lanu nishmadnu, and he imagined to completely annihilate us, mehityatsev b'kol gvul Yisrael, from all the borders of Israel, yuten lanu shiv'a anashim mibanav, give us seven men from his children, v'hu kanum la'ashem, and we will hang them to God, B'Givat Sha'ul, in Givat Sha'ul, so we've talked a lot of times how Sha'ul is from the Giv'ah, from this hill, that's called Givat Sha'ul. It's also a neighborhood in Yerushalayim, which is obviously not where he lived, because he lived in the north. Bechir Hashem, the chosen of Hashem. Okay, so this kind of brings us back to the whole halachic discussion of Sheva ben Bichri and how they could offer him up to be killed. And this is actually a case of non-Jews asking for these. And so I don't think we're going to get into this here because we talked about it so much with Sheva ben Bichri, but basically what the commentators say is that the king has the prerogative to do this. He can overrule Jewish law and overrule the Sanhedrin, and he can do this, and that's why they're asking him directly. And you see this pause, this break in the narrative in the middle of the pasuk again. This one makes a lot of sense because they've just made this crazy, heavy, awful request. So you can imagine a pause. Vayomer hamelech ani aten, and the king said, I will give. So he made this unilateral decision, which he is allowed to do halachically. The kings have that right. The Rambam talks about it in the laws of kingship, and he agreed to do it. Okay. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the connection between Ira Hayairi, who was a Kohen, whatever that means, and this famine, this Ra'av. So the Gemara says, we'll just read it in English, having mentioned Ira Hayairi, the Gemara now states cites a related teaching. Rabbi Arba Bar Zavta said, whoever gives all his priestly gifts to one priest has acted improperly and brings famine into the world as punishment. So just to review a little bit of the halacha, in Eretz Yisrael, you actually had to give your truma maaser. I'm not saying it properly, because some of it went to the Levi'im and some of it went to the Kohanim, but you had the choice of who to whom you gave it, and they had to come and collect it. So there wasn't like one central collection where it was then divvied up equally to the Kohanim. You actually got to choose. And the Gemara here is assuming that Ira Hayairi was actually a Kohen. And so as it is stated, also Ira Hayairi was a priest for David, which invites the question, was he a priest for David alone and not for anyone else? So obviously you couldn't have your own private Kohen all to yourself. Rather, it means that David would send all his priestly gifts to him alone. For example, he was the only priest to enjoy David's gifts. So David did not spread the wealth. He only gave it to Ira Hayairi. And it is written afterwards, and there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. Okay, so that's based on this teaching. Whoever gives all his priestly gifts to one priest has acted improperly and brings famine into the world as a punishment. So it seems odd that David would have acted in this way, but that's the Gemara that relates these two things. Okay. And then I wanted to include, this is one of my favorite teachings. I always teach it with regard to Megillat Rut, because there was a Ra'av with Megillat Rut as well. So there are actually 10 famines that came to the world. So this is actually a commentary on the ground being cursed, which is from Bereshit, I think with Cain. No, it must be Adam's sin when the ground is cursed. Sorry, I don't know exactly. This midrash is repeated, I think, at a lot of when the famines are mentioned. This midrash always shows up. So Asarashne Ra'avin Ba'ulolam. There were 10 years of famine that came to the world. So this lists, I put it in small print. You guys all know the famous one with Avraham. Right after he arrives in Eretz Yisrael, he has to leave and go to Egypt. There's another one with Yitzchak, where he goes to the police team. And then, of course, the famous Yosef famine. And there was one in the Shoftim that we learn about with Megillat Rut, because it says, Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, in the days that the judges judged. That's a famine. And this one, Ve'chad Bimei David, and one in the days of David. And it quotes our pasuk, Vayhi Ra'av Bimei David, Gimel Shanim.
Did you say that's 10 famines or 10 years of famine? It's more than 10 years, right? You meant 10 famines, 10 actual famines.
Yeah, 10 actual famines. I don't know why. Asarash Neira Avon Ba'ulolam.
That's what I was asking about. It doesn't...
Yeah, it's funny because this one is obviously 3 years. So I don't know why it says that. It's a good question. I was also thinking about that, and I don't know why. Okay, so the reason why I love this midrash is, and I have to bring it to you, even though it's not really relevant to our case, is because the 10th famine, Ve'achad Le'atid Lavo, one is going to be in the future. So the final 10th famine is going to be in the future. Shene Amar, as the Pasuk in Amos says, Lo Ra'av Lelechem Ve'lo Tzamei Lamaim. It won't be a famine of bread. They won't be hungry for bread, and they won't be thirsty for water. Ki'im lishmoa et devar Hashem. Rather, it's going to be a famine to hear the word of Hashem. So I just think that we're sort of living through that famine now, as we have the continuation of the Baal Tshuva movement that was started probably in the 50s. I don't know if you want to disagree with me or say something, but like, and continuing even to this day, and I'm sure I've told you this before, but it always bears repeating that Kohelet Yeshiva, which sponsors our shir, I feel like is in and of itself a revealed miracle. I always ask my students, raise your hand if both your parents grew up Shomer Shabbos. I say my own children who attended Kohelet Yeshiva could not raise their hand because I did not grow up Shomer Shabbos, nor did my husband. And it is always a ridiculously high percentage of students who cannot raise their hand. 1 year, it was a class of 40 kids, and 3 of them could raise their hand. So this is this pasuk and this idea of this 10th famine really speaks to me in terms of my day-to-day connection with my students at Kohelet and how many of them are in Kohelet Yeshiva because of decisions their parents made in the last 20, 30, 40 years of devoting themselves to Torah and mitzvah. Okay, and then I have the rest of the Midrash translated, so I'll just read it in English. Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Yirmiah, in the name of Rabbi Shmuel, by Rabbi Yitzchak, said, the main fourth of the seventh famine on the list, which is our famine that we're dealing with now, struck during the time of David, but it should have been in the time of Shaul. However, and we saw that in the pasuk that we read, that it might all be a result of Shaul killing the Gibonim. So why wasn't it during the time of Shaul? However, because Shaul was a sycamore sapling, a weak branch of a tree which bears poor fruit, Hashem rolled it over and brought it in the days of David. Shiloh sins and Yochani pays. Shiloh, of course, is from the northern kingdom, and Shaul was from Binyamin. And I'm not sure what the Yochani, it's a pasuk somewhere, so I didn't look it up, I apologies. But it's, you know, the kingdom of Israel versus the kingdom of Yehuda, and Yehuda being David has to pay for the sin of Shaul. That is why all the famines come in the days of mighty men who can bear them and not in the days of broken men who cannot bear them. And this is, you see this in Roots, that Elimelech, the Midrash tells us, would have been able to support the entire town of Beit Lechem for 10 years with his storages. And rather than supporting his people, he just left and went to Moab. So he showed he was not a strong man. But Boaz was. Okay, so, and not in the days of broken men who cannot bear them. Rabbi Chia the Great said, this is like the glass blower who has a container of cups and vessels. When he desires to hang up the container, he takes a peg and bangs it into the wall and hangs from it. And only afterwards does he hang the container on it. So meaning he tests out the peg to make sure that it will support his container of glass. That is why they do not come in the days of broken men, but in the days of mighty men who can bear them. And this is also obviously a commentary on Shaul, who wouldn't, according to this midrash, would not have been able to bear the famine that came during the time of David HaMelech. And we saw in our learning of Shaul that he really gave under pressure all the time from the people, and that's why his kingship didn't continue, because he didn't have that strength. Okay, I apologize. This is from Yehoshua Perek Tet, chapter 9. I forgot to title it. And we're just going to go through this entire perek quickly in English because it gives all the background information that we need to know about the Givonim and who they were and what they did. Okay? So if you're already familiar with it, I apologize. But it was the only way I can think of to just read through it. And it was when all the kings that were on this side of the Jordan, in the hill country and in the valley, and all of the shore of the great sea opposite Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard of this. Okay, so this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so you guys probably know there are 7 Canaanite nations, that there was a mitzvah to expel from the land and kill. We're going to talk about what that mitzvah meant and if there was any way around that mitzvah. Malbim's going to mention it. The Malbim already explained that the Gibonites came from the Amorites. They were a subset of them. So the Gergashim that we say in, they're actually mentioned in Shacharit every morning right before Shirat Hayam. I'm kind of showing off. I think I've mentioned to you before, I never really davened every single thing in Shacharit before until this quarantine, so I'm really becoming very familiar with all of it. So the Gergashim, I think we're going to see, they actually were the only ones who, upon hearing that Bnei Israel would be coming to conquer, left of their own accord, and they went to Afriki. That's what it's, Aleph, Pei, Resh, Yud, Kuf, Yud. So I assume that's Africa. So they left. So they're not mentioned here. Okay, but all these 6 Canaanite nations were still there. They gathered to war with Yehoshua and with Israel with a single accord. And the inhabitants of Givon, so remember, Malbim told us they're from the Amorites, heard what Yehoshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, So these were two cities that Yehoshua completely conquered. And they also acted with wile. Like wily, I think it should be. It could maybe be guile. I don't know if wile's a word. Anybody heard that word? I don't know. And they went and disguised as ambassadors, and they took worn sacks for their donkeys and wine bottles rotten, split, and tied together. Okay? So even though it's probably going to be an hour journey to get to Bnei Israel, they make themselves look like they have been traveling for days. And they don't know that these battles actually, that Yehoshua sent out letters ahead of time offering them to surrender. And they didn't. So they think that we, Bnei Israel, are just out to conquer everything without any regard. And that's actually debatable, but we'll talk about that later. Okay, and worn patched shoes on their feet, worn garments upon them, and all the bread of their provisions was dry and moldy. So they really prepared for this to dress up as if they'd been traveling for months or weeks. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant land, and now make a covenant with us, a brit." And each of the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you dwell in my midst, and how can I make a covenant with you? How can we make a brit with you if you are in fact one of the seven Canaanite nations?" And they said to Yehoshua, "We are your servants." And Yehoshua said to them, "Who are you and from where do you come?" And they said to him, "From a very distant land have your servants come, because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites that were on the other side of the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who was in Ashtarot." Wait, let me just, this is why I'm confused, because I knew that they were Amorites. Yeah, and this is Amorites. I don't know, because okay, I don't know. I'm a little confused with Ammon and Amorites, but it doesn't matter. It's not what we're studying right now. I apologize. "With our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey and go towards them and say to them, we are your servants and now make a covenant with us.'" So they're asking for a brit. "This is our bread we took hot for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we set out to go to you. But now behold, it is dry and has become moldy. And these wineskins which we filled were new, and behold, they are split. And these our garments and our shoes are worn because of the very long journey." So it's sort of like they doth protest too much. But Joshua is going to believe them. "And the men took of their provision and did not ask counsel of the mouth of the Lord. And Yehoshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swore to them." So they all made this oath. And this is actually a real problem, because even if they were able to make some sort of deal of surrender with the Canaanite nations, they're not allowed to make this kind of brit with them. Malbim's going to talk about this. "And it was at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard that they were their neighbors and that they dwelt among them. The ruse is up. It only took 3 days. And the children of Israel journeyed and came to their cities on the third day." So it's just a 3-day journey as opposed to a week's long journey. "And their cities were Giv'on and Chafira and Be'erot and Kiryat Yarim. And the children of Israel did not smite them because the princes of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord. So they honored their oath, even though it was on false premises." The God of Israel, sorry. "And all the congregation complained against the princes." So now the Bnei Israel want to know, why can't we kill them? They lied to us. "And the princes said to all the congregation, 'We have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. Now therefore, we may not touch them. This we will do to them and let them live. And there will be no wrath upon us because of the oath which we swore to them.' And the princes said to them, 'Let them live.' So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water to all the congregation, as the princes had spoken to them." Anybody know where hewers of wood and drawers of water are mentioned before this? We're going to see it. If you don't remember, it's okay. So just keep that in mind. "And Joshua called for them, and he spoke to them, saying, 'Why have you deceived us, saying, we are very far from you when you dwell among us? And now you are cursed, and they shall never fail to be slaves from you, and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told to your servants how the Lord your God commanded his servant Moshe to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. And we were very afraid for our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now, behold, we are in your hand, as it seems good and right to you to do to us, do. And he did so to them, and he delivered them from the hands of the children of Israel, and they did not slay them. And Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day in this place which he would choose. Okay.
That mean they were slaves?
Yeah, they were sort of like sub-converts. So they were accepted, but not fully. They were second-class citizens. But Rashi says that when it says that they acted wily, that was that weird word, wildly, I would have said cunningly. So they also acted with wile, just as Jacob's son dealt cunningly with Hamor, the father of Shechem, who was a Hivite, and the inhabitants of Gibbon were also from the Hivites. Okay, so this is when they said, yeah, you can marry our sister, but you all have to circumcise yourselves. And so they also dealt cunningly. It says that explicitly in the Pesukim. So it's just interesting that we're dealing with the same people here. Okay, and then in Devarim, we originally, it's Parshat Netzavim. And so everyone stood on that day at the end of the Torah, towards the end of the Torah, your young children, your women, your convert who is within your camp, both your woodcutters and your water drawers. So Rashi there says, the mention of these people separate to the main community of Israel teaches us that in the days of Moshe, Canaanites came to convert to Judaism, just as the Gibeonites came to convert in the days of Yeshua. This is the meaning of the verse regarding the Gibeonites, and they also acted cunningly in the parak we just read, pretending that they had come from a faraway country. When they were discovered, Yehoshua made them woodcutters and water drawers for Israel. Likewise here, the Canaanites attempted to deceive Moshe, but they did not succeed, and Moshe did not accept them to be Jews. Rather, Moshe made them woodcutters and water drawers, slaves for Israel. Okay, so we're just going to finish with this Malbim that describes this. I think I'm going to skip a little. I think this Malbim really describes everything. It's long. So the inhabitants of Givon, so this is the Malbim on Yehoshua, okay, Perek Tet. Hem shamu gam ken ma she'asa Yehoshua li'yericho ula'ai shelo patach lehem b'shalom. So they heard what Yehoshua did to Yericho and Ai, that he didn't open with them with peace. V'lo hichya kol neshama, and he didn't let anyone live. V'chashvu gamkin shelo yikablum Israel, and they thought that also Israel wouldn't accept them. V'hine lefi da'at Rambam, but behold, according to Rambam, Perek Shishi Mehilchot Malachim, Halacha Dalet, Nitzdavu Yisrael gam b'melchemet mitzvah shehi melchemet sheve yamim likro aleihem l'shalom. So the Rambam interprets that it's also in a melchemet mitzvah, which is the war against the Canaanite nations in Israel, that we were commanded, even in the war with the seven nations, to give them an opening of peace, to allow them to surrender. So that's an explicit pasuk, and there's a debate among the Rishonim whether the mitzvah to open in peace applies only to Milchamet Reshut, which is an optional war, or does it also apply for a Milchamet Mitzvah, a commanded war, which is the one with the seven nations. V'kablat ha-shalom talui im yikablu shlosha devarim. So it wasn't just like, I surrender, okay, we won't kill you. It was actually dependent on three things. Mas, they had to accept taxes upon themselves. The avdut and slavery, they would become slaves. The sheva mitzvot b'nei noach, and they had to observe the seven Noahite laws. The az mechuyavim lahashlim imahem, and then they'd be obligated to make peace with them, and they would not be allowed to kill them and to kill them off, as it's written in Devarim Perek Kaf. I think it's Parshat Ki Tetzei. V'haya im shalom ta'ancha, if they answer you with peace. V'yakol ha'am hanimtzeba yu lecha lamas ve'avducha, then the entire nation that's found there will be for you. They'll pay you tribute and they will serve you. But in any case, they were not allowed to make a covenant, like we saw in Perek Tet of Yehoshua, because they didn't realize that they were one of the seven nations of Canaan, Derech Ahava, by way of love, as it's written in that same Perek of Devarim, Lo Tichot Lehem Brit, you can't make a covenant with them. V'lachein hitlonenu al ha-nisi'im shekiblu et yoshvei Giv'on. And that's why they complained, the nation complained on the princes, that they did receive this with the settlers, the inhabitants of Giv'on. V'pnei shekartu lehem brit, they made a covenant with them. Ma shelo patach Yehoshua b'shalom b'yericho ve'ai. Yehoshua did not, because they thought that Yehoshua didn't open up with peace with Yericho and Ai, so the people of Givon, they did this ruse because they thought Yehoshua didn't give the people of Yericho and Ai a chance to surrender. Mipnei shekodem she'avart Yarden shalach shlosha prosdigmaot. But in fact, Yehoshua had sent three letters when they were still on the other side of the Jordan. Harotzeh lehashlim yashlim. Anybody who wants to make peace can make peace. That is to say, they can receive upon them the tax and the servitude and the seven mitzvot. Ubezeh patach b'shalom klali l'kol b'nei ha-medina. And that's how they opened with peace, a general peace with all of the inhabitants of the state. V'rayato, and a proof of this, v'ma shekatav, which what's written in chapter 11 of Yehoshua, lo hayta ir asher hishlima et b'nei Yisrael bilti hachivi, ki me'et Hashem hayta l'chazek et libam likrat ha-milchama. So there was no city that made peace with Bnei Israel except for the Chivites, which maybe that's talking about the Givonim here. I'm not sure again, sorry. Because it was from Hashem that he strengthened their heart to greet them with war. Mivu'ar she'im hayu rotzim lahashlim. That is just, it explains that if they had wanted to make peace, hayu muchrachim lekablan, the Jews would have been forced to accept them. And then he says how Rashi and Ravid disagree on this Rambam, and they say, no, there was no obligation to open up peace on these seven nations. They just had to go in and kill them. But that's not how the Rambam paskins. Ulefize hutzrach leva'er po madu hutzrachu yoshvei giv'on harim hu mipnei shesham uma she'asa li yericho la'ai v'ta'u she'en mekablim v'shalom. And that's why it needed to explain here that the Givonites thought it was similar to Yericho and Ai, and they were mistaken that they hadn't opened them with peace. Now, I just, the only thing I wanted to say here was that it mentions the Gergashims. Okay, but I'm not going to spend time looking for it, sorry. Okay, so that is the Malbim on Yehoshua, and I think we're going to stop there. And so starting next week, we're going to go back to Perek Hafala from the beginning, and we're going to read Rashi and Malbim on those things. And we'll
Next week or 2 weeks.
All right, 2 weeks. Yeah, 2 weeks. Next week, I will not be here. So thank you, everyone, for coming. And I will send
an email today, so just reminding that there's 5 o'clock next week. Yeah,
yeah, I'll send an email. And I'll send an email the next week with the new set of sources that will include these things.
Great, thank you.
Did David tax the Northern Kingdom, Israel, and Yehuda equally? Because my understanding is that Shlomo taxed the Northern Kingdom, but not the Southern Kingdom.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Because it seems that he's taxing Yisrael. The question is, we've seen Yisrael refer to so many different things in the last few parakim that I don't know what it means. It's a very good question. And it really would be unfair if they weren't taxing Yehuda also. So I don't know.
This is an elementary question, but all these nations that are supposed to be destroyed, how did they earn that if they didn't want to be destroyed and they'd rather be slaves? I can blame them, in other words.
So that was the option that they did have, according to the Rambam, not according to Rashi, remember, that they could have been mashlim, they could have taken on these obligations of servitude, tax, and the seven mitzvot. It seems that nobody responded to Yehoshua's letters, nobody did it, and the Gergashim fled to Africa. I forgot where the pasuk is, but it says that the Amorites still hadn't fulfilled their quota of sins. This is how Rashi interprets it. So meaning they were so evil and they were so idolatrous, but they had to accumulate whatever amount of sinning in order for them to deserve to be destroyed. It's an interesting notion. Like, had they done tshuva, where would we, B'nai Israel, be right now? I don't know. They were that evil. And we're going to see a malbim also when it says about this aside that the Givonites were not among B'nai Israel, and that it's going to say that this awful request they made for 7 innocent people to be killed shows that their cruelty really kept them apart from B'nai Israel, and they maintained this idolatrous attitude towards life from the Canaanite nations. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll see that inside in 2 weeks. Okay, thanks, guys.